Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Argentina's debt comes due and the vultures are circling. The vulture funds, that is. What insurers make of driverless cars, plus high fives and superhero movies. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 31st of July, and it's great to have you with us. Argentina has defaulted on its debt for the second time in 13 years. The country's leaders blame investment funds that bought Argentine bonds, and they've sued to be paid in full. The Argentine government is calling the investors who hold the debt vultures because they stand to make such a tidy profit. That's pejorative, but it's also a technical term. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains what a vulture fund is.
Vulture funds earned their nickname because they are, in a sense, scavengers. They go after the debt of dying firms or crisis-addled countries. They buy it on the cheap when nobody thinks it'll get paid back, and then they sue to get it paid back in full.
These firms profit from the backs of poor people.
Eric LeCompte runs Jubilee USA. It's a religious group that lobbies for financial reform. He says so-called vulture funds have gone after poor countries, even after aid money.
One of the most tragic recent examples is money from debt relief was sent to Zambia, but that money that was supposed to build schools and hospitals was collected by vulture funds.
But some say these are extreme examples that give these investors a bad name. Ed Altman is a professor of finance at the NYU Stern School.
Asking for full payment is totally appropriate.
He says often funds are better suited to play hardball, to get back what's owed. And like vultures in the wild, vulture funds may serve an important ecological purpose.
They provide, in the case of distressed assets, a liquidity that simply wouldn't be there.
In other words, it's helpful to have somebody out there who will buy bad debt. Anna Gelpern teaches law at Georgetown. She says vulture funds thrive and people can fight about them because of a hole in international law. There's no bankruptcy court for countries. There are no rules on how creditors should get paid back.
All you have are a bunch of contracts and it's, you know, every person in fund for themselves.
And in the case of Argentina, Gelpern says there is no winner. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Since the financial crisis, relatively few individuals have been held responsible. Well, that small group got a little bit bigger yesterday. Someone who used to work for the mortgage lender Countrywide was fined as part of a civil fraud case. Marketplace reporter Tracy Samuelson looks at what happened and at the larger question of holding individuals responsible.
It was nicknamed The Hustle, a program in which Countrywide allegedly passed bad mortgage products onto investors like a hot potato. Because Bank of America acquired Countrywide in 2008, the bank was fined nearly $1.3 billion for the fraud. But a former Countrywide employee, Rebecca Mayon, will also have to cough up $1 million of her own money. This is not the norm, says Ken Thomas, an independent bank consultant and economist.
We're seeing companies paying fines, but very little actions against the people involved. After the savings and loan crisis, there were many savings and loan executives that went to jail. Here we don't see that.
Countrywide's former CEO and CFO were also fined coming out of the financial crisis. But generally, when individuals are targeted, they're typically lower-level employees who worked directly on the bad deals, says Michael Santoro, a professor at Rutgers Business School.
It's a little more difficult to present evidence against people who have set policies in motion or who might have turned the other way or, you know, who might have winked at something.
According to the Securities and Exchange Commission, there have been 174 enforcement actions against companies or individuals arising from the financial crisis. About 40% of those have been against CEOs, CFOs, or other senior executives. But many of those actions were on a different scale than this case, says David Zaring at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
Ms. Marone is, you know, she's in a unique place. There's an actual jury verdict that came in against her and a fine that was duly awarded after that verdict. Almost everything the SEC's done has been a settlement.
Zaring says early failed criminal cases against a pair of Bear Stearns employees might have been a deterrent. And that if wrongdoing was such a widespread practice in the financial industry, it can be hard to single out individuals. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, let's just say you could hear the trombone section practicing that sad music from a mile away. It was not a happy day. Markets had their worst one-day drop since February. Traders apparently not pleased about some weak earnings and the possible end of the Fed's stimulus program. Details when we do the numbers. To take a moment to think about something you probably never think about, rarely think about. The high five. Think about when you use it, how often you use it, how many people use it, all over the world. Well, the filmmaker Michael Jacobs wondered where it came from, and he's made a short film about it for Grantland, for ESPN. And I asked him how the first high five came about. It was October 2nd, 1977, at Dodger Stadium.
It was the final game of the regular season, and three players on the Dodgers had hit 30 home runs, and Dusty Baker was sitting on 29. And it was his last at-bat of the regular season, and there was a lot of tension as to whether or not he was going to hit that 30th home run. And he got up there, and he smacked one out of the park. And as Baker was rounding the bases, a young rookie came out and just spontaneously threw his hand up in the air and slapped Baker five.
You interview the journalist John Mualim, and he says that high five by Glenn Burke just came out of him. Just describe for me what it looked like.
Sure. I mean, you know, most people refer to Glenn Burke as sort of a guy who could high five you just by looking at you. This was a guy with was so full of life and so full of enthusiasm, and, you know, was somebody that that the team really loved. And when he came out and did that high five, you know, sports writers who were there that day wrote about it right away because they said it was just such a moment and it was just such an energy in that stadium and in that time. And they had never seen anything like it before. And so from there, the Dodgers sort of rallied around the high five, and they even trademarked it. And it became a part of their rallying cry for the postseason and the following, you know, 2 years into 1980 and 81.
Wait a sec. They trademarked the high five?
They did. They actually went ahead and registered a trademark for the high five and made these flyers that they handed out for spring training in the 1980 season.
Any idea what happened to that trademark?
I think what happened was they rode the high five wave for 2 or 3 years there. And then, you know, the next wave came in and it was something different. They just moved on. And it was a less important part of their rallying cry.
Glenn Burke has this larger than life personality. He's also just huge as well, and had this sort of cult following. People loved him. What did this gesture, what did this high five mean for him, for his career?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Glenn, of course, was that soon after that high five, you know, celebrated around the world and was spreading into other teams in baseball and really throughout the sports world, he soon found himself out of favor in the Dodgers organization amidst rumors of his sexual orientation. And this was a guy who was very comfortable in his own skin. He was comfortable with who he was. And because of that, he was put in some pretty uncomfortable positions, and he found himself traded up to Oakland, and then within a year facing a lot of pressure and scrutiny about these swirling rumors of his sexual orientation, was forced out of the game.
And not even 2 decades after he gave that first high five, he ends up contracting HIV.
Yeah, and unfortunately, he died too early. But what's, you know, great is that he left this incredible legacy behind, and you know, part of our story here is to just celebrate that legacy of this player and this person who meant a lot to a lot of people. And really the high five gives us an opportunity to share his story and to celebrate his legacy in that way.
Mike Jacobs is the director of The High Five. That's one of Grantland's 30 for 30 shorts. Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Most of us will shop around for a deal, but have you ever noticed that for some products, every store, no matter if it's made of bricks and mortar or if it's online, every store charges the exact same price? Starting tomorrow, that's what'll happen with Johnson & Johnson's contact lenses. Dan Bobkoff reports.
I have bad eyes, and I like saving money. So I was a little dismayed to get an email from a big online contact lens store that said, starting tomorrow, I can forget about getting a deal on some of the most popular contact lenses around.
For consumers, this can mean no coupons, no rebates, no bundle discounts, or any other specials that could lower the price to below what the manufacturer has set.
This is Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, kicking off a Senate antitrust hearing yesterday on controversial new contact lens pricing.
We'll call the hearing to order. And
what's happening here is something called a unilateral pricing policy. Johnson & Johnson, which makes the top-selling AccuView brand, is joining other manufacturers and telling eye doctors, big box retailers, and online stores that they can't charge less than a certain amount.
If a retailer sets the lenses for below that price, then the supply of that particular contact lens would be cut off.
At the hearing, Joe Zeidner of 1-800-CONTACTS was not pleased.
And if the point is to save consumers money, I don't know why we have a minimum price we can't go below.
First of all, they can compete on other things.
Barbara Sikalidis is a partner at the law firm Pepper Hamilton. She says there are often good reasons for unilateral pricing. Companies like Bose use it to maintain cachet. Others like Samsung use it to help combat showrooming, helping stores staff with knowledgeable salespeople compete with online sellers. John Zhang teaches pricing at Wharton.
The one benefit is the fact that you're going to have more services provided to you when you buy some very complex products.
But buying contacts is different. Your doctor has already told you what to buy. And eliminating discounts may make you more willing to buy directly from the optometrist. That's the accusation made by contact lens discounters. At the hearing, Dr. Millicent Knight of Johnson & Johnson said the new pricing is simpler and cheaper for most.
A price that is actually lower than the current national average selling price to consumers.
But that's just the average. For the roughly 10% of shoppers who buy online, prices will likely go up. And sorry, all this is perfectly legal, as long as manufacturers aren't actively coordinating prices among themselves or with retailers. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Here's a question. If a car crashes in the woods but no one's driving it, who's responsible? Maybe the more important question is who's liable? That's a serious question. Starting next year, driverless cars will be allowed on the roads in the United Kingdom. Here in the U.S., California and Nevada have passed laws allowing the testing of autonomous vehicles, as they're called. We wondered what the driverless car means for car insurance, so we sent Sally Herships to find out.
Pretty much everything bad that happens behind the wheel today, our fault.
Today, 95% of accidents are actually driver error.
Robert Hartwig is president of the Insurance Information Institute, an industry association. He says when cars drive themselves, there'll be a lot fewer accidents. Chris Schultz is with the California Department of Insurance.
The data seems to support that these cars will be better drivers than most people because they don't get distracted, they don't turn around and talk to their kid, they don't play with their cell phone.
Which should mean cheaper insurance, right? But this is where Schultz says things get hazy.
We might see decreased frequency of collisions, but increased severity.
Severity of repair costs. You might pay more because the cost of high-tech repairs is higher. Then there's the liability issue. Frank Dauma is with the University of Minnesota's Center for Transportation Studies.
The question really turns into who is in control of the driverless car.
Dauma says the answer could mean analyzing data from the car after an accident, looking at its black box. But self-driving cars still have classic problems where liability is clear. The Insurance Information Institute's Robert Hartwig again.
Cars could still be stolen. Trees could still fall on your car.
So Hartwig says, although we can expect to see a significant number of autonomous cars on the road by 2020, he says, don't plan to cancel your insurance policy. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, if you're lucky enough to write a superhero movie, you've got a lot of options.
I could call him up and say, bring me, you know, anything you have that involves a character who is a genius, and that's his superpower. And he would bring me, you know, 16 different characters going back to the 1950s.
The research assistant, a superhero in his own right. But first, let's do the numbers. hear those trombones. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lopped off 317 points, 1.8%. Close at 16,563. The NASDAQ tumbled 93 points, 2%, to finish at 4,369. And the S&P 500 fell 39 points, also 2%, to wrap at 1930. ExxonMobil slipped more than 4% on lower-than-expected oil and gas production last quarter. Yum Brands, the parent company of KFC and Pizza Hut, dumped almost 5%. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged up just slightly to 2.56%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. It's the first of the month, and it's a Friday. Lots of reports with loads of data to analyze. Pace yourselves. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending as well as construction spending for June. Automakers are scheduled to report sales for last month. And the one that's sure to come up over dinner, the Labor Department releases its jobs report for July. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Japan is facing a demographic crisis. The country's population has been plummeting. Its birth rate is one of the lowest in the world. And the Japanese are moving from the countryside to cities. That's raised the specter of a Japanese countryside that's empty. We're talking about deserted villages, abandoned farms. Changing demographics are taking a real toll on Japan's small, remote islands, as the BBC's Mark Whitaker reports.
Shiraishijima is one of a cluster of islands which spangle Japan's glorious Seto Inland Sea.
Hello, my name is Amy Chavez. Welcome to Shiraishi Island in the Seto Inland Sea. The island is 570 people. I've lived here 17 years, and when I came here 17 years ago, there were 900 people.
So a lot of people have left then, Amy.
Left permanently, they have.
This is a beautiful house here. I mean,
it is. It's over 100 years old. As you can probably tell, no one's living in it right now. The people who have lived here and have always lived here stay, and then after they pass on, then the houses become vacant. The problem here, of course, is jobs. Traditionally, the only jobs that they have done here are fishing, stone mining, and then there's a bit of summer tourism on the beach.
Right. The harsh economic truth is that as the young head for the city, country life in Japan is dying, and has been for decades. Today, barely 15% of farming households can make ends meet from agriculture alone. Most rural workers must hold down two or even three jobs to survive. And the exodus from the countryside to the city is all too evident on Shiraishijima.
Amy, this is the tiniest class I've ever seen.
Eight students. Yeah, it's pretty small, isn't it?
And how many teachers are there?
There are seven teachers.
Seven teachers for eight pupils.
That's right.
In a school that could house probably 800 or 1,000 pupils.
Right.
As night falls, a fair proportion of the island's population has turned out on a gravel yard, illuminated by the lights from the village hall. They're practicing an ancient ritual, a dance they will in August perform in full costume on the sands. The Shiraishi Odori dates from the end of the 12th century and commemorates a savage sea battle between two clans, in which it's said the inland sea turned crimson with the blood of the dead. All the children from the school are here. The kids are being taught the ways of the past in the hope they will one day pass on that knowledge to their children. These are the new and precious lifeblood of a community which has endured for millennia, but which is now facing an uncertain future.
In the Seto Inland Sea, you've got like 250 inhabitable islands, but each actually has a distinct culture. And, you know, now they're talking that in another 5 years we might have to close the elementary school because there will be no more students. And, of course, once you no longer have a school, then the whole island just, you know, dies, because that's really the center of everything. The kids aren't just learning the, you know, things that they can go to any school and learn. They're learning the culture of the island as well. Once that school closes, then, you know, no one will ever learn this dance again.
Shiraishi Odori, the dance of the island, practiced here for the past 800 years. And with a new generation of islanders, hopefully, for the next 800 as well.
The latest superhero movie from Marvel opens today, Guardians of the Galaxy. And it's the kind of big summer movie that costs a lot of money that the studio expects or hopes will also make a lot of money. Nicole Perlman co-wrote the film with James Gunn, who directed it. And this is, incredibly, her first credit as a screenwriter. Hey there, Nicole.
Hi, David.
So I want to ask you, first of all, you had all of these Marvel characters you could have chosen. You pick these five. You pick this ensemble. What made you choose them?
Well, you know, there were many of the characters in the Guardians of the Galaxy in the 2008 reboot that made it into the film. But I think the reason that I chose those particular five characters is that each one brought something very specific to the team. And with Quill, he's sort of the fun, charming, kind of saucy guy that we all sort of know. Rocket and Groot had, you know, brought a lot of heart to the story. I thought that Gamora, you know, you need a really kick-ass woman to be part of the team for sure. And she's probably my favorite female character of all the Guardians of the Galaxy. And in terms of Drax, you know, he's the one that you really feel is extremely dangerous. And for a team of villains, you need somebody who you feel like really could rip out your spine if he chose to.
You mentioned you needed a lead woman, and that's something that's probably still too rare in the comic book world.
I agree. I mean, there's a lot of them in comics, but in terms of movies that are focused primarily on a female lead, I think it's something that will become more common as we go, but it's still considered a bit of a risk, and hopefully that will change.
Do you have a longstanding interest in comics, or was this sort of a radical departure from what you'd been doing?
It was a bit of a departure, but it was very much strategic, I think, on my part, because I had a background in writing science and technology-related scripts, a lot of projects that were space related. And I wanted to get into a larger scope in terms of popcorn movies, fun action adventure movies. And it was kind of hard to prove that I could do that in Hollywood. I wasn't very well versed in Marvel until I started working there. And then I became well versed very quickly. I had a lot of reading to do, a lot of catching up to do.
I can only imagine. I mean, the Marvel world, the Marvel universe, I suppose, seems so big, and there were so many people and all kinds of creatures populating. I mean, how do you find your way through all of that?
Well, they had a great research assistant, and I could call him up and say, bring me, you know, anything you have that involves a character who is a genius, and that's his superpower. And he would bring me, you know, 16 different characters going back to the 1950s. And so it was really fun. And honestly, my husband got very jealous, because I would come home every night with stacks and stacks of comic books to read and be like, oh, I have to read all of these before bed. And he's like, oh, boo-hoo, poor you. You have to read a ton of comic books for work. So it was pretty enjoyable, the process of acquainting myself with this world.
How does your love of sci-fi sort of come across in this movie? Are we going to get a sense of that when we see it?
Well, I mean, I think a big part of the experience of working at Marvel is learning about spectacle and learning about what makes a really fun ride. So as much as I am a kind of a science nerd and was insisting on no explosions in space and things like that, you know, there are some compromises that have to be made in terms of telling a really exciting visual tale and balancing that with the science. You know, I'm part of this organization called the Science and Entertainment Exchange. I'm on the steering committee for it. And one thing that really surprised me was that so many scientists are less interested in the accuracy than in ideas that people might not have thought about that haven't made it to the screen yet, whatever's coming next in their world. And so in a way, that kind of helped me get over some of my hangups about everything being scientifically accurate. After all, we do have a talking raccoon. So, you know, it probably wouldn't be great to get too hung up on the nitty gritty.
You said you wanted to prove you could write a movie like this, a big popcorn movie, as you said. Does that change everything? I wonder what you're working on now and if this has sort of opened the doors to other things that you hadn't been able to do in the past.
I think it definitely has. I've been offered different types of projects, or the chance to, you know, pitch and go after different types of projects than I ever would have had before working for Marvel. So it's been really nice. And in a way, I think people appreciate knowing that women are writing in this genre. I think it's kind of a rare thing. So there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement for trying to open some of those doors. So fortunately, I'm seeing a lot more of that right now.
Nicole Perlman co-wrote the script for Guardians of the Galaxy. Nicole, it was great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note out of Battle Creek, Michigan, some news from Kellogg, maker of Fruit Loops and Apple Jacks and Corn Flakes. Well, the company's having problems because of what I just mentioned. Americans are not buying cereal like they used to. And that, the company says, has led to a sales slump. Profits were down 16% last quarter. Another factor, cereals like Special K used to be popular because they were low calorie. Now, Kellogg's CEO says, Americans are more interested in foods that are more nutritious. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lopped off 317 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ tumbled 93 points, 2%. And the S&P 500 fell 39 points, also 2%. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.